Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the blowout victory by Andrés Manuel López Obrador, affectionately known as AMLO, in the Mexican elections, where he won the presidency with twice as many votes as his nearest rival, while his party Morena captured 260 of the 500 seats in the Chamber of Deputies and 65 of the 128 seats in Mexico's Senate. Margarita Favela, a professor of political science at the National Autonomous University in Mexico, where she researches social movements and political institutions, joins us to discuss the revival of hope and a sense of joy in Mexico. We will analyze whether this clean sweep will cleanse the political landscape now that a revolutionary leftist populist leader who ran against endemic corruption and rampant violence will hold the powerful presidency for 6 years. And we'll assess whether AMLO will be able to change the system with the help of his new Morena party in the Congress, who, like him, will not be taking bribes. And although AMLO ran against the very corrupt establishment he now has to negotiate with, Margarita Favela predicts the new president's first 2 years will not be confrontational, but in the last four, the changes that the Mexican people are demanding and expect will be realized. Then we will speak with Julian Salazar, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, about his concerns that the Democrats are making a big mistake in calling for the abolition of the federal agency ICE, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. He is the co-host of the Politics and Polls podcast and joins us to discuss his article at CNN, "Abolish ICE is a Massive Political Mistake," and argue that at a time when the focus should be on Trump's cruel and immoral border policies, Democrats are undercutting their own message as Senators Warren and Gillibrand play into Trump's hands by allowing him to brand Democrats as advocates of open borders. Then finally, we'll examine the latest warning from the Federal Reserve's forecasters that the federal funds rate, currently at 1.9%, is headed to 3.4% by the end of 2020, meaning that we will be paying more for mortgages, car loans, and credit cards. Dean Baker, senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, joins us to discuss how the economy appears to be improving while the net worth of the richest Americans is up an average of 27%, but for what is left of the middle class, wealth has declined by 20 to 30% as Trump's tax cuts for the rich cut into the share of the pie for the rest of us. And joining us now from Mexico City is Margarita Favela, who is a professor of political science at the National Autonomous University of Mexico, where she researches social movements and political institutions. Welcome to Background Briefing, Margarita Favela.
Hi.
So this is quite an extraordinary victory on the part of AMLO, Manuel López Obrador, not just in terms of the presidency, but also in terms of the Mexican Assembly. I mean, he's done extraordinarily well. My understanding was that the PRI and the PAN basically figured they were going to lose the presidency, but were going to put a lot of resources into at least holding on to the assembly. But it looks like this was a massive wave of support for AMLO.
Yes, it is, because I think Mexicans are fed up with corruption, and we basically see that PRI and PAN are the continuation of the situation we are living in the last 25 years. And it is clear for us that only changing not only the executive but the legislative, it's the only way to go ahead with the real change in Mexico.
So what could go wrong then? I don't mean to be pessimistic, but with control of the executive branch and the legislative branch, do you see a clear path ahead for AMLO?
Yes, but it is not going to be unilateral power, because the alliance that put López Obrador on the presidency, and also the group that is behind the legislative power. It is an alliance of very different type of political forces. So it is under the Morena flag, but it is a coalition of different set of political forces. So it's not necessarily that it means that it's going to be an only one way of transformations of political reforms. It is going to be a negotiation, and the most leftist or radical positions can be contrasted or regulated by other positions that are more on the right. I mean, the only thing that is common in both sides is that all of us are against corruption, against impunity, and in favor of economic growth as the basic for fighting those two major problems in Mexico. So I don't think we are going to see a set of political reforms in only one way. I mean, it's going to be a negotiation, and basically the organization of society is going to be the real force behind the eventual transformations that we see.
So, but who will López Obrador be negotiating with, and this new political party, Morena, of his? Will they be negotiating with the business elite, with the military? Sure. What are the power centers in Mexico?
I would say that the military, I mean, I can be wrong, but the history of political history in Mexico, the political history in Mexico since the revolution shows that the army, the navy, I mean, the armed forces are basically institutional. They are not the support of the right, I mean, exactly, or some, you know, they are basically not a political actor by themselves. So the real negotiation is going to be between those that have been, those forces, those actors, those institutions that have been playing the role of people who negotiate or who uses the political power to empower themselves and to use for particular and personal benefits the power of the state. So basically, the struggle, I mean, in this first period, it's going to be between that political, I mean, an economic elite that is has been beneficiated with the privatization process, and they are basically accustomed to deal with corrupt politicians to gain advantages in the economic field.
But didn't he run against these very people? If you say he has to negotiate, does he have to negotiate with the very power centers that he ran against in the elections as the epitome of what's wrong with Mexico, the lack of economic fairness, the concentration of wealth in the hands of a few families, the collusion that the pre-party and the pre-party dinosaurs have had with the drug trade? These are massively powerful and sinister forces, are they not?
Yes, I think he's going to be forced to negotiate with them. They have, 12% of the private investment in Mexico. So they are people who have to be heard, not to be, can be avoided or ignored. But the thing is, how is he going to negotiate? The thing, I mean, my perspective is that he's not going to put very heavy things on the first year or even in the first 2 years, because he is going to be to try to build more powerful power in social, not only the electorate, not only electoral forces, but more social forces in the sense of being able to create defense that some more important reforms are needed. But I think he's not going to try to do them in the two first years. So he's not going to confront the political elite. He's going to basically don't move the water too much. And in that sense, he's going to negotiate that the things are... The only thing that is going to change radically, immediately, is the use of political power, I mean, the use of the government power to fabricate, to use that power to do private business. That is the thing that he's going to cut. He's not, in my perspective, he's not going to change all the things that they have done. He's going to stop it from here on.
And again, I'm speaking with Margarita Favela, who is in Mexico City, where she is a professor of political science at the National Autonomous University of Mexico, where she researches social movements and political institutions. So, but the people that he's brought in, this new party, Morena, it sort of reminds me of Emmanuel Macron in France, where he created a whole new party out of nowhere and suddenly got a massive landslide elections, and the traditional parties in France, the socialists and the conservatives, just sort of evaporated. They disappeared. Is that a similar thing that's happening now in Mexico?
No, I don't think so. I'm not very, very expert on what happened in France, but I think this Morena party didn't come out from nowhere. I mean, López Obrador has built a grassroots movement since 12 years. I mean, 15, 20 years ago. So there's a lot of organizations, grassroots organizations, that are behind this power. But those people are not looking for transformation, a radical transformation, in the sense that to put out or to expel or to expose the economic powers out of the picture. They just want to stop them to use the governmental power to keep on empowering and enriching themselves. And that creates enough opposition from them.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, Margarita Favela, what you're telling us is that you have a whole new majority of politicians in the legislative branch that have been elected along with the new president, who are not corrupt, who are not going to take bribes. And that in itself is going to be radical. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yes. That's the bet of most of the people have voted López Obrador. Some of us are looking for something more, but not in the two first years. Mm-hmm. I think... We can part the sexenio in two or three phases.
Right.
And I think in the very beginning, he's not going to confront those powers in other way that one.
Right. So the sexenio, meaning the six-year term of a president,
yes.
The first two, mm-hmm. he will just do what he can. He won't challenge the power structures outright. But then... Mm-hmm. In the second two and the last two, that's when he's going to, well, tell me, what do you think will happen in years 3, 4, 5, and 6?
Yeah, I think he's going to try to consolidate that electoral coalition that put him in the power now, to build it in a way that can promote more deep reforms, some structural changes, in a way not against the private property, but in the sense of fostering a different pattern of economic development, more centered in the national industry, or more to create a domestic market, trying to put again the sovereignty in within the country, and lessen the foreign dependency. And but for that he needs to improve to get an economic growth. That the Mexican economy has basically been stagnant for the last 20 years or more. So those changes can be immediate.
So do you think, though, I mean, Donald Trump here in the United States keeps talking about he has his enemy is the deep state, you know, the people that are investigating the possibility that he's a criminal and that he's got ties to Vladimir Putin. He accuses the intelligence service, security services, the FBI, the Department of Justice in this country of being the deep state. Is there a deep state in Mexico? In other words, can López Obrador trust the security services, the very people that are protecting him?
Well, this is a big question. I'm not an expert on security issues, but the thing he has said is that the CISEN, which is the entity in charge of domestic security, it's going to be washed out. He's going to reorganize completely the political, I mean, the policies and the security policy. But I don't think, I don't think we can compare in that sense the Mexican state and the American state. They are very, very different ways of dealing with the opposition and very different ways of dealing with the security of the state.
Right. Well, I gave you a bad example because I was talking about what Donald Trump refers to as the deep state. And we have a president who doesn't make any sense and lies all the time. So that wasn't perhaps the best way to pose the question. But just in closing, I take it there must be a lot of sense of optimism and a sense that of a new era. Is that what I'm sensing?
Yes. Yeah, you're right. That's the feeling we have in Mexico right now, that we are inaugurating a new era in the political relations in Mexico, mostly because the majority of the people, it's acknowledging that they have grassroots power, that we have powers as citizens. And that is something really new for us. We have had revolutions, but that is a different sense of power. And in this moment, we have the feeling that we can do the things in a specific way. It's a long-term or a medium-term transformation with immediate effects in some aspects. But basically, we are feeling that we can, from here on, to start reorganization of the society based on the power of the citizenry. And that is different. I mean, that is something new for Mexico.
Well, Margarita Favela, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Margarita Favela, who is in Mexico City. She's a professor of political science at the National Autonomous University of Mexico, where she researches social movements and political institutions. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with a Princeton historian who believes that the Democrats are making a massive mistake calling for the abolition of ICE. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, whose books include Arsenal of Democracy, The Presidency of George W. Bush, The Fierce Urgency of Now, and his latest book is The Presidency of Barack Obama, A First Historical Assessment. And he's the co-host of the Politics and Polls podcast, and he has an article at CNN, Abolish ICE is a Massive Political Mistake. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julian Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
And President Trump tweeted out on Sunday, the liberal left, also known as the Democrats, want to get rid of ICE, who do a fantastic job and want open borders. Crime would be rampant and uncontrollable. Make America great again. Now, while that may well appeal to Trump's base, I think he's aiming it at a broader audience, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. I think all tweets like that and all his rhetoric about immigration, obviously it's to appeal to his loyal followers. But I think with this issue, he feels that he can win over most of the Republican Party that supports his hardline immigration policy, and even potentially reach centrist Democrats who might see Democrats as radicalizing on this issue. So I think his ambitions are pretty grand, both for the midterms and also for the 2020 election, where he sees immigration as being a key issue in putting together his coalition.
But in your article, you make it clear, Julian Zelizer, abolish ICE is a massive political mistake. You make it clear that focusing on the abolition of ICE rather than the end of Trump's policies of breaking up families is basically the Democrats. That's a huge gift to Trump.
Yeah, I think it is. And I think a lot of this just unfolded over the weekend, where much of the weekend started with this real outburst of opposition that you saw in the streets of many cities and suburbs of the country, protesting the separation of children from their families and protesting the way in which this administration speaks about immigrants and is cracking down on immigrants. And there was a shift where by the end of the weekend, the discussion started to center on ICE, on this government body that few people, I think, even know what it is or had heard about it until now. And that has created an opening for the president to attack. And I also think, just as important, it takes attention away from the real-world impact that his policies are having, which was actually generating a lot of public opposition.
Well, what they did, at least to my mind, and I think to a lot of people, was inhumane and immoral, and I don't think you can retreat from that. People who make those kind of decisions could, I think, rightfully earn the wrath of a lot of voters, if not the majority. I think, aren't the polls indicating that something like two-thirds of Americans disapprove of what Trump has been doing, separating children from their families at the southern border?
They do, although the polls for the Republican constituency in terms of his general policy is very high in terms of support. So that's also a number that has to kind of be in the conversation, that he still holds the Republican electorate and many approve of what he's doing, maybe not the particulars in terms of this part of it, but the overall strategy.
And on Saturday at these rallies, Elizabeth Warren, Senator Warren and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand both advocated for ending ICE as we know it. I think there's been a lot of enthusiasm on the Democratic left as a result of the election. There's a surprise upset victory in the Democratic primary in New York's 14th district by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And she, in many ways, ran her campaign highlighting her belief that ICE should be abolished. But isn't there a bit of a danger there on exaggerating that victory in the sense that I think she won by like 20,000 votes? I mean, one of the lowest turnouts imaginable. I think in total about 40,000 people voted out of, what, 250,000?
Right. That's absolutely correct. And that's always the trick with special elections, trying to evaluate especially ones that defy the conventional wisdom, how representative they are, even within the district they take place, but certainly nationally. And will the kinds of arguments and will the kind of campaign that worked in that case with that portion of the population work at a much broader level? Can it be replicated in parts of the country that look very different and which have different candidates trying to articulate the message? And so Democrats do face a risk of taking this victory and taking the kind of campaign it is and arguing that this should be almost a one-size-fits-all model for the rest of the country. And on immigration, the danger is taking parts of the argument that seemed to work in her campaign, and which could be good policy arguments, and assuming that politically they'll work at a much grander level. I'm not sure that's the case. And I think in this case it might be a very good policy argument, but in terms of the politics, I don't think it's going to work well for the Democrats.
But that's not to say that within ICE itself, apparently, or with, at least within the Homeland Security Department, which contains ICE, there's not some disconcerted people about what's happening, particularly with Trump's border policy of separating children from families. My understanding is that a lot of these officers are very troubled by it. So I think, wouldn't it be a more intelligent strategy to sort of exploit that, not just to brand them all as being a bunch of stormtroopers, but try and figure out a way, because the message to abolish ICE, of course, plays right into Trump's hands, rather than, say, reform ICE?
I think that's right. I mean, I still don't think reform ICE is a great political slogan, again, just because most people don't know what ICE is, and it takes attention away from President Trump, which is a name that I think garners more opposition. But trying to reform this government body is certainly something that would have a lot of support. And as you say, there are voices from within the agency who are not happy with what's happening as a result of the president's policy. Some are not even happy with the basic organization of how we handle immigration, which changed after 9/11. And if this became the focus of a policy debate, I'm sure sympathetic members could have testimony from agents themselves, and you could hear a lot of support for really changing what we have done since 9/11 and rethinking the entire policy. So I'm sure that would be a very fruitful discussion, and you could probably get a diversity of voices, including agents themselves, who don't like how this is working.
Well, I just mentioned that off the top of my head. I'm not offering up an alternative slogan. I was more or less suggesting that rather than abolish, the idea would be to suggest that there's another way to do it without handing Trump the gift of appearing to not want any kind of borders, which I think is exactly what is helping Trump.
And President Trump thrives on a kind of clarity of his argument. It's often wrong, it's false, it's misleading, but it has a very clear message. That's what you're dealing with if you're a Democrat going up against this president. And so I think an argument that says abolish ICE and then we can reform it or change it into something different, which is what some Democrats were trying to explain, it's going to be difficult to sell that against someone who's just continually punching that basically Democrats want to get rid of any enforcement, even though this isn't even the government body that handles the border. But Democrats really need to think about that, given the kind of campaign they're going to face. And the president will be involved in the Republican midterms.
Well, I've never understood, Julian Zelizer, why the Democrats have been taking these absolutely scandalous and vicious punches from Trump, accusing them of wanting to flood the country, infest the country, have MS-13 people come here and murder people and create mayhem just to get the votes of the MS-13 members. He's been saying the most outrageous accusations about the Democrats on this immigration issue, and they've never punched back. I haven't heard a word from Schumer or from Nancy Pelosi. And I frankly am reminded of what happened with John Kerry in 2004 when Karl Rove manufactured this Swift boat attack on on Kerry to take away his strongest asset, that he was a Vietnam War hero. And, of course, there were questions about George W. Bush being a draft dodger. Then Kerry never fought back. And my understanding is that a lot of people, particularly in the South, think that, you know, if you're attacked and you're a gentleman, you stand up for yourself. And if you don't, you're a coward.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. And it's a problem within Democratic Party politics that people have been wrestling with. And the Swift boat example that you give is just a great example where, you know, Republicans did what didn't seem possible. They took their candidate, the president, who hadn't even really served, and they went after a veteran. But somehow they turned the veteran into the person who was anti-war, who was against service. And they threw everything out there. They threw false information and kind of scandalous character assassination, and it worked. And Kerry tried to take the high road, but there are moments when the high road will just lead to defeat. And in this case, you have a president who's saying these kinds of things, not simply about Democrats, but about the people who are trying to come into this country. The kind of language is astounding that he's willing to use. And I do think that's really where Democrats have to focus their ire. And they're going to have to punch back, as you say. Not, I hate to use those words, but they will have to be very rhetorically tough to combat some of what's out there. And thus far, they haven't really been able to do it. I think he's really shaping the debate on many issues.
And again, he tweeted out on Saturday, Trump, the Democrats are making a strong push to abolish ICE, one of the smartest, toughest, and most spirited law enforcement groups of men and women that I've ever seen. I have watched ICE liberate towns from the grasp of MS-13 and clean out the toughest of situations. They are great. So there's Trump tying in this canard about the invasion of the United States by MS-13 to the Democrats' call to abolish ICE. So again, I don't think you have to be a sophisticated political analyst to see that the Democrats are digging a hole for themselves here and taking everybody's eye off the ball. What we should be talking about is the cruel and inhumane and immoral behavior of Trump and Nielsen and Kelly and the people in this administration who actually came up with this idea of separating children from their parents, which we haven't seen since the Nazis. So that's just what I find extraordinary.
Yeah, it was a really troubling, upsetting moment in American political history that just happened. And this was a lot of the rhetoric that the president has used, both as a candidate and as president. It was coming to life. It was being implemented. You saw what it actually meant. All of that language started to add up to something very real, and that meant kids being removed and kids being put into these inhumane conditions. And then even after the executive order, it was very clear there's no plan to bring people together. It was all sloppily done, or not even sloppily done. I think it was consciously not thought through, is to send a message. And that is an issue which, if you are a Democrat, you should be able to figure out how to talk about something like this in a way that really hurts the president politically and the party that has supported him. And so there's a very real issue after a historic moment, I think, that just happened, which Democrats can't lose their focus on, either because of changing the debate to ICE or moving on to other issues. This should not be passed over too quickly.
And in your article, Julian Zelizer at CNN, Abolish ICE is a Massive Political Mistake, you point out that the absurdity of the perennial Republican call to abolish the IRS at least works on the level that people know what the IRS is, but they don't know what ICE is. So there's a problem there. But just in terms of the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and how she mentioned in her campaign In an interview with The Intercept last month, she concluded that abolishing ICE doesn't mean getting rid of our immigration policy, but what it does mean is to get rid of the draconian enforcement that has happened since 2003 that routinely violates our civil rights because, frankly, it was designed with that structure in mind. Now, she's an impressive young woman. There's no two ways about it. So you think that they've just fallen into the trap of throwing out the wrong headline rather than a more nuanced version of what they're saying?
No, I think it's about the timing. I think what she's talking about is an extremely important debate, but it would really have to happen after the Democrats regain control of Congress at a minimum. It's a policy debate, and it's about restructuring government. It's about the design of our policies. And I think she has a very good point, and it's an important one, about how the reconstruction of how we handle immigration after 9/11 is dysfunctional in many ways and has to be reformed. But now it's campaign time. Now we're going into the midterm elections, and this will not be as easy as many Democrats thought. And, you know, if they don't regain control of the House at a minimum, this will be seen as a loss, and you'll have a president who is amped up politically to move even farther with a very rightward agenda. So I think it's a message and an idea that might have worked in her campaign, but for Democrats, this is not the right timing. And it's not even about the headlines. I think it's very hard to imagine this working as the marquee issue at this moment, at least going in through November.
Well, is this a reflection of a perennial problem, at least that I see with liberals and progressives, is that they'd rather be righteous than effective, that they're much less pragmatic than Republicans are. Republicans just want to win. They don't get troubled by ideological inconsistencies, whereas it does seem on the left people's sense of righteousness overwhelms any sense of making the kind of pragmatic decisions that we're talking about that are necessary to get rid of Trump and to win back the House and to begin to get rid of Trump. I mean, you're not going to get rid of him, and it's not that likely that they'll be able to take the Senate. But, I mean, all this talk about incivility versus civility is a complete red herring as far as I'm concerned. I think we are at a crisis in this country for the very survival of American democracy. So, to my mind, the stakes couldn't be higher, and I just fear that a lot of righteousness is getting in the way here of a kind of determination to, you know, roll up your sleeves and get the job done.
I think that's right. I think the Democrats have really been hurt. They've hurt themselves in part as a party in the last decade or so. I think 2016, the state of the party was not good, and that should have been a wake-up call. Not only did, you know, Donald Trump win the presidency, but you had a Republican Congress, you had Republicans controlling many state legislatures and gubernatorial seats, and Democrats were really in a defensive position. And going into these midterms, it's very hard for Democrats to win back the Senate just because of the hole they're in. And even the House, it's still difficult to win a majority. And given everything that President Trump has done, which is pretty unique in many ways, and certainly the extremism of his rhetoric, the incivility of his presidential leadership, you would think that this would be relatively easy for Democrats to have a big backlash election. But it's not. And so I think Democrats need to think pragmatically. They have to be hard-headed about how do they regain the votes. If you don't have the votes in American politics, the ideas won't really go very far. And many would agree, this is a moment of crisis. And this is a moment when every leader of the Democratic Party needs to be front and center, helping in this struggle. And the party needs to be thinking smart, and they have to be thinking within the world of politics that they operate, how do you win, rather than an ideal world in terms of how they would win there, because that won't get them Congress.
And I think you have to add to that, Julian Zelizer, that because of gerrymandering and the Electoral College, the Democrats have to win about 7 to 8% more votes than just breaking even.
That's exactly right. The gerrymandered districts right now really put the Democrats they're moving uphill, and so they need bigger wins. And that's also no gerrymander, but in terms of the Senate, the number of seats they are defending versus the Republicans is not in their favor. There's a curb in the election, and we're not going to. It looks like the court is certainly not going to move in the direction of changing our districting system right now. So it comes back to politics and political decisions.
Well, just in closing, though, is there if indeed the Democrats are pandering and hoping to get a big Latino turnout, is there any indication that there will be a big Latino turnout?
I haven't seen the polls to show that yet, and I don't know. You know, midterms the turnout is always low, and in parts of the electorate that don't vote in as high as numbers, it's going to be even lower. So, if there's a constituency that should be really mobilized right now, it should be the Latino community, given the kind of presidency that's taking place. But Democrats have to be the conduit, and they have to do the old-fashioned door-to-door grassroots mobilization and then smart messaging to make sure those votes happen, because they might not, and it could be a rebellion against both parties in the end, and that would hurt Democrats more than Republicans.
Well, Julian Zelizer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. His books include Arsenal of Democracy, The Presidency of George W. Bush, The Fierce Urgency of Now, and his latest book is The Presidency of Barack Obama, A First Historical Assessment. And he's the co-host of the Politics and Polls podcast and has an article at CNN, Abolish ICE is a Massive Political Mistake. We're going to take a brief station break and be back examining the latest warnings from the Federal Reserve's forecasters. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Dean Baker, a senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He's the author of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive, Rigged, How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And he writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, where he has an article, New York Times Gets Hysterical About Non-Existent Debt Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Dean. And New York Times actually has an editorial on Monday, Your Credit Card Will Pay for the Next Recession. And they point out that the Fed forecaster's median prediction is that the federal funds rate is headed to 3.4% by the end of 2020 from the current 1.9%. And that will mean that people will be paying more for mortgages, car loans, credit card balance, etc. Not a good message for millennials, is it?
Well, it's not. I think the debt side of it really is exaggerated, though. I mean, in the scheme of things, the higher interest rate on mortgages that we may see as time goes forward, that's not going to be the worst thing in the world. I mean, the rate on 30-year mortgages today, I'd have to double-check, but I think it's somewhere around 4.5%. That's historically a very, very low rate. So if that goes up to 5%, that's not the worst thing in the world. What concerns me much more than the higher interest rates is that it's going to slow the economy. And what we don't need is fewer jobs, more people out of work. So when I think of the Fed raising rates, that's what concerns me, the fact that people pay somewhat more on mortgages, or they emphasize credit card debt, which is really tiny in the scheme of things. That's not a big concern for me. Again, not good, but it just doesn't really add up to very much.
But the New York Times op-ed also says that rates are rising in a time when household debt reached a record $13.21 trillion in the first quarter, and household debt service payments as a percentage of disposable income hit 5.9% in the first quarter. What do you make of those?
Well, it's just incredibly sloppy. You'd like to think that they had someone with some familiarity with economics that wrote these things or at least read them. The economy's growing, so it would be surprising if debt wasn't hitting record levels. So what you would look to is debt to GDP. That's absolutely not at a record level. And what the other thing you would look at is debt service to GDP. They're 5.3%. I think that might have – I'm actually not even sure what they meant, because if you look at the numbers, it's higher than that. But the point is it's near a historic low. Our data, the Fed's data – I mean, you can construct other data sets, but our Fed data goes back to 1980 – and that's near the lowest it's ever been. So it just really is sloppy. Again, I'm not happy to see the prospect of the Fed raising rates. That's not good news. But it's not the story that they have in that editorial at all.
And again, I'm speaking with Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He's the author of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive, Rigged, How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And he writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, where he has an article, New York Times Gets Hysterical About Non-Existent Debt Crisis. So what did you make, though, of Ben Bernanke's statements, the former chairman of the Fed at the American Enterprise Institute recently, where he talked about the overstimulation of the American economy and the results of the massive tax cuts for the rich, the $1.5 trillion Trump tax cuts for the rich and for corporations, saying that it makes the Fed job more difficult all around because what you're getting is a stimulus at the very wrong moment. What do you make of that?
Well, it's important to be clear what Bernanke is saying. What he's saying is the economy is pretty much at full employment right now. So if we had more demand in the economy, it's going to lead to inflation. I don't see that. We see very little evidence of inflationary pressures anywhere in the economy. Wages are not rising. There's no acceleration, I should say, in the rate of wage growth. I actually would like to see that. But there's very little evidence that wage growth is more rapid today than it was a year or 2 years ago. The price indices, the consumer price index, the personal consumption expenditure deflator, these are the indices that the Fed looks at to measure inflation. If you look at the core pulling out energy and food prices, which is standard, they do that. I mean, this is my invention. It's standard. No acceleration whatsoever over the last 4 years. So Bernanke's making a very strong claim here. I understand other economists would agree with him, but I don't think the data supports it. I mean, the fact is he and other economists were saying that we couldn't get the unemployment rate much below 5%, if at all. And here we are at 3.8%. So fact is they've been wrong on that. We've all been wrong on things, but this is one that they've been wrong on in a really big way over the last 4 or 5 years. And I don't think he's right now. I think he's still wrong that the economy has room, which, just to be clear, that's not a reason to give more money to rich people. The question is just, what are the consequences? I mean, in my view, the reason why the tax cut was such a bad idea was we gave money to the richest people in the country who have been doing just great over the last four decades. And what that meant was that was money that we're not going to be using for free college or for making health care costs cheaper or a whole variety of other needs that I think most people would say are more important.
Well, as it happens, the net worth for the richest Americans is up an average of 27%. And for the middle class, or what's left of the middle class, it's decreased 20% to 30% in real terms. Again, I'm quoting from this New York Times lead editorial in Monday's New York Times. Do you have any problems with those statistics, Dean?
Well, no, they're absolutely right. I take a little bit of issue with the meaning of them. I mean, the rich are doing very well in their net worth. They're absolutely right on that. for the middle class, the base year is important there. They're looking at 2007. That was the peak of the housing bubble. So it's kind of like, you know, let's not play games here. Again, I know how to play games with numbers. They're playing games with numbers. That's not a realistic base of comparison. I mean, they must have seen the housing bubble. If you want to do a serious comparison, say go back to 2000, pick some other business cycle peak, in other words, and make that comparison. I should also say, I think net worth, the importance of that is overstated. So most people really don't have much wealth. And in a lot of ways, it's arbitrary. And if that sounds strange to you, let me be very, very concrete. If you go back 40 years ago, most middle-class families had a defined benefit pension. As we ordinarily add up net worth, that defined benefit pension doesn't count for a penny because it's not that I have $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 I can just grab. It guarantees me a certain income for as long as I live, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, whatever it might be. That's become very rare. Okay, so if we just look at that, defined benefit pensions have been replaced by 401ks, which generally haven't filled the hole. But suppose we had someone who go back to 40 years ago, that person can count on getting $30,000 a year in retirement for as long as they live. That's what their defined benefit pension was. Suppose that person today has no pension, but they have $150,000 in a 401k. We'd say they're $150,000 better off if we use a net worth measure, because that's net worth. Their pension wasn't. So that's what I'm saying. We can play games with net worth. Most people don't have much to speak of. Obviously, it's better to have more than less, but it's really not a very good measure of people's well-being.
So how do you think the politics are going to play out for the Democrats in this election in terms of having an economic message? They don't have any message whatsoever, as far as I can tell. They don't have a narrative, and Trump's been saying the most outrageous things about Democrats wanting the MS-13 street gangs to invade America and just to get them to vote Democrat. They never speak out. They never defend themselves. It's a strange situation. But as far as I can tell about the politics of the Democratic Party, you have the kind of I could call it the Bloomberg wing, since Michael Bloomberg is now not necessarily being a Democrat, but he's certainly running against Trump and deploying his money against Trump. And then you have the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wing, which everybody's enthusiastic about now with her surprise election, even though I think they're exaggerating the significance of such a low turnout. So do you see that bifurcation in the Democratic Party in terms of its economics?
Absolutely. I mean, you have kind of the traditional wing, whatever you want to call them, who seem to think that their best route to winning this fall is just to say we're not Donald Trump. And to be clear, there's a lot to be said in saying, I mean, I think it's very clear the guy is half crazy. I mean, he does not, he is astoundingly ignorant about current events, even as president. I mean, he seems to know very little about issues that you would like to think sort of an educated 12-year-old would know about. That's very scary. So saying that you're not Donald Trump should be worth a lot. But on the other hand, to really get people out to say this election is going to make a difference in your life, well, saying, yeah, we're going to do something about health care costs. We're going to make it affordable for you. We're going to make college affordable. These and other things that will directly affect people's lives, I think that's going to be the sort of thing that will motivate more people to come out. I don't rule out that the Democrats would win just by saying we're not Donald Trump, but that's kind of a weak thread to base your political efforts on.
So what do you think would be an effective economic message?
Well, I certainly think things that are very concrete, like saying healthcare, we're going to make healthcare affordable, having a clear plan. I mean, I know many are talking about Medicare for all or single payer, which I think is fine, but we're not going to get there overnight. So whether it makes sense to say we want single payer with the understanding that, no, we can't do that next year. You know, maybe that's something we're going to shoot for 10 years from now or something. But making it clear, we have a plan, we're going to make healthcare affordable for you. And again, free college is a very doable task. You look at the numbers, it's not that much money. And it would make a huge, huge difference in a lot of people's lives, particularly, and again, this is something I'll have to say, I was originally not a proponent of free college because I was saying, you have middle-class families, they could afford to pay something for college, families earning $100,000, $120,000 or something. And then, two 2 points. One is there aren't that many of those. And the other is families are complex. You have families that parents are separated, and maybe one, typically the father's the higher earner, and maybe they're earning $100,000 and they could pay for college, but they don't feel like they should have to pay. And maybe they should, but are you going to tell the kid, oh, you can't go to college because your dad's an asshole and he doesn't want to pay and we have no way to make him? So when you consider complications like that, you just go, how much bureaucracy, how much work do you want to go through in order to make sure that, you know, the people who can afford to pay actually do? I mean, it just seems to me make more sense insofar as we need the money, get it out of their taxes. You know, so people who earn over $100,000 a year will pay somewhat higher taxes. That makes more sense than saying, okay, we have to make sure someone pays for college.
Well, just in closing, the former Republican who was key in John McCain's presidential campaign, key advisor Steve Schmidt, who's a regular on MSNBC, he's left the Republican Party. And the other day, he was, I think, in the context of talking about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's election, he warned that the Democrats were guilty of what he called dishonest progressivism by promising all this free stuff but not saying how it's going to be paid for. And it's somewhat like what happened here in the state of California. There was a bill up in Sacramento to have a single payer for all health care, but it didn't really crunch the numbers and it went down to defeat because people were skeptical of it. Do you think that's a valid criticism?
Well, people have to run for office, so I'm not going to tell them exactly what they should say. What I would say is that, in principle, none of these promises are unaffordable. They might not be affordable if you tried to do it tomorrow. So you will have to make changes. We have to bring health care costs down. We have to pay less for our drugs. We have to pay less to our doctors. We have to pay less for medical equipment. So all these areas where you have to bring down costs. And in that context, you have the countries that have single payer. You could point to the UK. You could point to Canada. They pay much less than we do. So it is very much doable. Do you have to raise some taxes at some point? Probably, but probably not all that much. If we get the cost, if our costs were in line with, say, Germany or France, we'd have to raise very, very little by way of taxes to have universal Medicare. So I don't think they're irresponsible promises. And the point I should make is there really is an incredible double standard because Republicans for years have been running on totally outlandish promises, and no one really gave them a bad time about it. So if the Democrats are making commitments where they can't write down, okay, here's how I'm going to pay for it, X, Y, and Z, they're just playing, you know, a fraction of the game the Republicans did. Again, I'm an economist. I like them when they write down X, Y, and Z, but I don't have to run for office. So given that that seems to be the way that politics is conducted in the U.S., I can't blame the Democrats for playing the same game.
Well, Dean Baker, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Dean Baker, who's a senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He's the author of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive, Rigged, How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And he writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, where he has an article, New York Times Gets Hysterical About Non-Existent Debt Crisis. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Levy-Vallat. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.